Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you very much to all of you for coming along for this lecture. My reflections today have been inspired by a number of factors. One, of course, as was mentioned, my work with the Henry Martin Institute for Islamic Studies in Hyderabad, which is where I first became aware of the 19th century story of polemics, Christian polemics against Islam. I felt that it was a rather one-sided affair, as you probably already know. The second factor that got me interested in this was that just last year I acquired a student from South Asia, from Pakistan to be precise, who is now working on a 19th century convert from Islam to Christianity. His name is Imaduddin. He was an imam working in northern India then, undivided India. There are a number of missionary sources that claim that Imaduddin converted as a result of the polemics, particularly that of Karl Fander in 1857. As you know, it's a big debate that took place in the middle of the 19th century in Agra. It's also called the Agra debates. I realized that Christian approaches to Islam and other faiths are rather more nuanced and variegated now than they used to be way back in the 19th century or the early 20th century. But the attitudes of many Christians toward Muhammad and Islam continue to be unhelpful. Thirdly, my readings on revisionist historiography. There's plenty of it out there if you're interested. A number of authors whose names I'll be very happy to pass on to you. That is bringing to light new narratives of Muhammad, his life, and Islam. So the Orientalist narrative that we have kind of imbibed or acquired is being challenged by a large number of revisionist historians. Also, the Islamic narrative of how Islam came to be is being challenged by revisionist scholars, and we will look at some of that in due course. And finally, my own research on the Gujjars of the Rajaji National Park in northern India, which was recently published by Walter D. Greuter. It's not on this topic, but all the quotations that you see in the handout passed on to you have been borrowed from this book. My interest has always been on the people on the margins, the subaltern groups, as they are called in my part of the world. My first research, my first monograph was for this reason on a group of Muslims called the Mahdavis. I don't know if you know anything about this group. They are a Sunni group of people living mostly in the state of Andhra Pradesh in South India and in Rajasthan up in the north. And now the Gujjars, the book that you have here. Please have a look at it whenever you have time. My approach to the topic is phenomenological, if I can pronounce this word. By that I mean I start not with texts or traditional accounts or theology or law, but with the empirical testimonies of the people as they have been presented to me. So without really making any judgments, I work with the material data I have been able to gather, and I take it on its face value without really making any premature judgments about it. And it's about a group of people that not many people care about. And that is the Gujjars. So who are the Gujjars? As I began researching among the Gujjars way back, I think about 7 to 8 years ago, I realized that there are two basic challenges that I had to face. One is to do with this whole problem of accessing ancient Indian history. How do you access ancient Indian history? It's a huge, huge challenge. Because much of what we have in writing is really not in full light. So much of what we have really belongs to religious sources. And obviously religious sources have got their own access to grind. That's the nature of sources when it comes to Gujjars. These are hagiographical sources, these are mythical sources rather than historical as we understand it. So that makes it extremely difficult, really, to separate history from myth, separate history from hagiography. Okay, narratives written from the faith point of view, from narratives written from the point of view of simply wanting to tell a story as it is understood, without any ideological color to it. Okay, so that's one of the problems that I had. Secondly, a large number of sources that I needed for research of this sort had been destroyed by various raiders, mostly Turco-Afghan, and I'm deliberately not using the word Muslim or Islamic, because there were other people also, and not necessarily Muslims who did this. And these people destroyed a large number of libraries in many parts of India. And so some of the key sources that we require in order to tell ancient Indian history have been razed to the ground, have been burnt. Thankfully, it's the Chinese who have preserved some of the Buddhist sources from an ancient Buddhist university in Nalanda. And so some of those sources have survived in the Chinese language because they had already been translated into the Chinese language. So that's one. Secondly, it's very difficult to really give you an estimation, an accurate estimation of the number of the Gujjars, because they've unfortunately not been counted in the censuses of India. So we don't have any reference to the Gujjars in the 2001 census of India and the one before that and the one before that. We don't have any reference to them also in the 2011 census. And so it's extremely, extremely difficult really to say exactly how many Gujjars there are. So how did I get my numbers? I got my numbers from missionary sources. And some of you might wonder, well, how reliable are the missionary sources? And I am relying on the advice given by Jeffrey Oddy. I don't know if you know this name, very well-known scholar, who says that missionaries need to be seen as social commentators. And there's no reason why we should, and we cannot rely on missionary sources. If missionaries are saying there are so many Gujjars, then we should accept it. Because there is no reason why they will tell a lie. Okay? And so the estimate of, or estimates of the number of Gujjars that I'm working with come from missionary sources. And my reason for choosing and relying on these sources is precisely this. So we're looking at nearly a total of 500,000 Gujjars. A large number of them are Hindu. Some of them converted to Islam. And in my region, the region of my research, there are a total of 70,000 of them, out of which I focused on 1,400 to 1,500 families living within a protected forest, national forest, called the Rajaji National Forest in northern India. So it was a much more doable research because, you know, these people were within a particular boundary, and it was easy for me to go into this national forest and meet with these people year after year. And my research was spread over a period of 3 to 4 years of data collection, and I was fortunate enough to meet with the same people each time I went into the forest. And so I was able to develop rapport and friendships with many of them. So that is just to give you some background on the difficulties I had. But what can be pieced together about the Gujars? Who are these people? What we know from all of these sources is that Gujars came into India in several fluxes, starting from the 7th century onwards. A large number of them came from Central Asia, but via Europe, particularly Eastern Europe, and the area known today as Georgia. So a good number of them had already been Europeanized in a sense, just like Turco-Afghans had been Persianized when they first landed in India way back in the 11th, 12th century. And they came in several fluxes because they were warrior kind of people. And there was already a kind of a fault line that existed between the Brahmins and the Buddhists of India. Brahmins saw in the Gujar influxes an opportunity to get even with the Buddhists, because the Buddhists were the real political power of this time. And so the Brahmins invited the incoming Gujars to become part of the Hindu caste system. And of course, they couldn't accord the same level, the same caste level as theirs, because only the Brahmins are the twice-born people. And so they invited them into the second level of the caste hierarchy, which was the Kshatriya and the Rajput warrior classes, whose job it is to protect the Brahmins. And so this is how the Gujars became high caste Hindus, the Rajputs and the rulers and the warriors of India. And for nearly 200 years, a large number of these Gujars became so powerful that some of them established two empires in India called the Gurjara Pratihar Empire, which lasted for nearly 200 years. In fact, longer than that, until the arrival of the Turco-Afghans in the 11th and the 12th century. So that's just to give you some background of that. Many of them converted to Islam as part of an agreement with the Turco-Afghans, who were quite clever, really. As they entered into the Indian territory, part of the agreement was that if they lost the battles, they would convert to Islam. And so a good number of Gujars who lost their battles with the Turco-Afghan people converted to Islam in this way. Some Gujars converted to Islam as a way of social and political protest against the sultans of Delhi. And they expressed their protest against the sultans by converting to a mystical brand of Islam, not to the orthodox imam-led and the scripture-centric orthodoxy, but to an experiential dimension of Islam. And this happened in the 14th century onwards. So as a way of protest against the ruling Muslim ruling minority in Delhi.